coming up next. 5 o'clock shadow with Robert Knight.
This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at Pacifica, New York station, WBAI. I'm Robert Knight, and in today's program, President Barack Obama addresses the issue of a downgraded American economy today. We'll hear his brief statement from earlier today, along with an analysis from Scott Klinger, Director of Tax Policy for the progressive organization Business for Shared Prosperity. We'll be speaking about disinvestment, reckless speculation, money bubbles and bursts, and misdirected bailouts. Also today, a critical dialogue on Social Security protection with Representative John Conyers, who says that President Barack Obama himself is the one who betrayed the sanctity of Social Security in the recent budget negotiations. Also, a chilling update on the Fukushima nuclear reactor system from Arne Gunderson of Fairwinds Associates. All of that and more, including a global wrap-up from INN, the International News Net.
Good afternoon, everybody. On Friday, we learned that the United States received a downgrade by one of the credit rating agencies. Not so much because they doubt our ability to pay our debt if we make good decisions, but because after witnessing a month of wrangling over raising the debt ceiling, they doubted our political system's ability to act. The markets, on the other hand, continue to believe our credit status is AAA. In fact, Warren Buffett, who knows a thing or two about good investments, said, if there were a quadruple A rating, I'd give the United States that. I and most of the world's investors agree. That doesn't mean we don't have a problem. The fact is, we didn't need a rating agency to tell us that we need a balanced, long-term approach to deficit reduction. That was true last week. That was true last year. That was true the day I took office. And we didn't need a rating agency to tell us that the gridlock in Washington over the last several months has not been constructive, to say the least. We knew from the outset that a prolonged debate over the debt ceiling, a debate where the threat of default was used as a bargaining chip, could do enormous damage to our economy and the world's. That threat, coming after a string of economic disruptions in Europe, Japan, and the Middle East, has now roiled the markets and dampened consumer confidence and slowed the pace of recovery. So all of this is a legitimate source of concern. But here's the good news. Our problems are imminently solvable, and we know what we have to do to solve them. With respect to debt, our problem is not confidence in our credit. The markets continue to reaffirm our credit as among the world's safest. Our challenge is the need to tackle our deficits over the long term. Last week, we reached an agreement that will make historic cuts to defense and domestic spending. But there's not much further we can cut in either of those categories. What we need to do now is combine those spending cuts with two additional steps. Tax reform that will ask those who can afford it to pay their fair share, and modest adjustments to health care programs like Medicare. Making these reforms doesn't require any radical steps. What it does require is common sense and compromise. There are plenty of good ideas about how to achieve long-term deficit reduction that doesn't hamper economic growth right now. Republicans and Democrats on the bipartisan fiscal commission that I set up put forth good proposals. Republicans and Democrats in the Senate's Gang of Six came up with some good proposals. John Boehner and I came up with some good proposals when we came close to agreeing on a grand bargain. So it's not a lack of plans or policies that's the problem here. It's a lack of political will in Washington. It's the insistence on drawing lines in the sand, a refusal to put what's best for the country ahead of self-interest or party or ideology. And that's what we need to change. I realize that after what we just went through, there's some skepticism that Republicans and Democrats on the so-called super committee, this joint committee that's been set up, will be able to reach a compromise. But my hope is that Friday's news will give us a renewed sense of urgency. I intend to present my own recommendations over the coming weeks on how we should proceed. And that committee will have this administration's full cooperation. And I assure you, we will stay on it until we get the job done. Of course, as worrisome as the issues of debt and deficits may be, the most immediate concern of most Americans, and of concern to the marketplace as well, is the issue of jobs and the slow pace of recovery coming out of the worst recession in our lifetimes. And the good news here is that by coming together to deal with the long-term debt challenge, we would have more room to implement key proposals that can get the economy to grow faster. Specifically, we should extend the payroll tax cut as soon as possible so that workers have more money in their paychecks next year and businesses have more customers next year. We should continue to make sure that if you're one of the millions of Americans who's out there looking for a job, you can get the unemployment insurance that your tax dollars contributed to. That will also put money in people's pockets and more customers in stores. In fact, if Congress fails to extend the payroll tax cut and the unemployment insurance benefits that I've called for, it could mean 1 million fewer jobs and 0.5% less growth. This is something we can do immediately, something we can do as soon as Congress gets back. We should also help companies that want to repair our roads and bridges and airports so that thousands of construction workers who've been without a job for the last few years can get a paycheck again. That will also help to spur economic growth. These aren't Democratic proposals. These aren't big government proposals. These are all ideas that traditionally Republicans have agreed to countless times in the past. There's no reason we shouldn't act on them now. None. I know we're going through a tough time right now. We've been going through a tough time for the last 2.5 years. And I know a lot of people are worried about the future, but here's what I also know. There will always be economic factors that we can't control. Earthquakes, spikes in oil prices, slowdowns in other parts of the world. But how we respond to those tests, that's entirely up to us. Markets will rise and fall, but this is the United States of America. No matter what some agency may say, we've always been and always will be a AAA country. For all of the challenges we face, we continue to have the best universities, some of the most productive workers, the most innovative companies, the most adventurous entrepreneurs on earth. What sets us apart is that we've always not just had the capacity, but also the will to act, the determination to shape our future, the willingness in our democracy to work out our differences in a sensible way, and to move forward, not just for this generation, but for the next generation. And we're going to need to summon that spirit today. The American people have been through so much over the last few years. Dealing with the worst recession, the biggest financial crisis since the 1930s. And they've done it with grace. And they're working so hard to raise their families. And all they ask is that we work just as hard here in this town to make their lives a little bit easier. And that's not too much to ask. And ultimately, the reason I am so hopeful about our future, the reason I have faith in these United States of America is because of the American people. It's because of their perseverance and their courage and their willingness to shoulder the burdens we face together as one nation. One last thing. There is no one who embodies the qualities I mentioned more than the men and women of the United States Armed Forces. And this weekend, we lost 30 of them when their helicopter crashed during a mission in Afghanistan. And their loss is a stark reminder of the risks that our men and women in uniform take every single day on behalf of their country. Day after day, night after night, they carry out missions like this in the face of enemy fire and grave danger. And in this mission, as in so many others, they were also joined by Afghan troops, seven of whom lost their lives as well. So I've spoken to our generals in the field, as well as President Karzai, and I know that our troops will continue the hard work of transitioning to a stronger Afghan government and ensuring that Afghanistan is not a safe haven for terrorists. We will press on, and we will succeed. But now is also a time to reflect on those we lost and the sacrifices of all who serve, as well as their families. These men and women put their lives on the line for the values that bind us together as a nation. They come from different places, and their backgrounds and beliefs reflect the rich diversity of America. But no matter what differences they might have as individuals, they serve this nation as a team. They meet their responsibilities together. And some of them, like the 30 Americans who were lost this weekend, give their lives for their country. Our responsibility is to ensure that their legacy is an America that reflects their courage, their commitment, and their sense of common purpose. Thank you very much.
That was President Barack Obama addressing the nation just a short time ago, earlier this afternoon. This is 5 o'clock shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And the president, of course, is calling for a return to Main Street values, rebuilding of the national infrastructure, but it remains to be seen just where the funds for such stimuli may be coming from, given the draconian measures of reducing the expansion of the national budget that accompanied the drama and combat and negotiation that led to a temporary budget solution. That was followed, of course, over the past few days by a downgrading of the stocks of American investment by the Standard & Poor's Wall Street Agency. And to help work our way through this morass of economic confusion, we are joined now live by Scott Klinger. He is the Director of Tax Policy for the progressive organization known as Business for Shared Prosperity, which describes itself as a network of forward-thinking business owners, executives, and investors committed to building enduring economic progress on a strong foundation of shared opportunity, financial equity, and technical innovation. Welcome to 5 o'clock shadow.
Thank you.
Scott, we just heard President Obama's address from just a short time earlier today. And for those who are not adept at the nuances of the language of mutual bipartisan economic exculpation, can you translate for us what he said and what he meant?
That's a little bit of a tough one, but it seemed like he kind of wanted it both ways. He was talking about the paralysis in Washington and then talking about the ways that one of the things that makes our nations great is that we have political will. And I'm not sure people believe that you can have it both ways.
Well, can you take us through what has just happened over the past week or two? We saw much drama and foot stomping. We saw the enactment of a temporary budget that includes a great number of severe social service cuts. We see a continuity of international operations and, most recently, a downgrading of investment in the United States from some sources on Wall Street. Can you tell us what the hell just happened?
Well, the way we see it as a network of small business owners around the country is that Wall Street has continued to downgrade Main Street. This is just another in a step of demands for wage cuts and pension and other healthcare benefit erosion, cuts in public services that the public depends on in terms of those provided by government. And as you said, whole new rounds of demands for austerity in social programs and Medicare and Medicaid and other things that most American families depend on a great deal. And the downgrading of the U.S. debt by S&P has had a huge effect. It will continue to make life more difficult for people on Main Street, working class people and poor people and middle class people. But it's not something that's new to people who are not new to the rest of us. We've known that this economy is heading in the wrong direction for quite some time, and that's, I guess, what the president was trying to address today.
Well, let's go anti-seriatim, the downgrading. How does that dribble down to a moderate wage earner? How does that really affect one?
Well, I think maybe the biggest way is that it will increase the political rhetoric and pressure to cut government services, cut government funding for programs. President Obama seemed to boast after the debt ceiling deal that he was cutting discretionary spending back to the levels of President Eisenhower in the 1950s. I don't think that's something really to boast about. One of the other things your listeners may not know, but it's worth thinking about since he invoked President Eisenhower, is what tax rates look like during that time. And during when Ike was president in 1952, the wealthiest Americans paid a top tax rate of 91% on their income. Today it's 35%, and most of them are screaming that that's too high. They want it to be lower. Corporations used to pay more than half of their profits in taxes in 1950. And today that number is down closer to 10%. So we've seen huge shifts. And the middle class has been asked to bear those cuts.
Scott Klinger, you're referring to President Eisenhower. Let's go further back to President Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the Social Security system that was established during his term. And we have seen this new budget, including proposals for the reduction of services under what I thought was a self-sustaining pay-in, pay-out system of Social Security, not to mention Medicare. What are the risks of altered services in that regard and altered payouts? In regard to Social Security in particular, I understand the government's been borrowing against it. Can you tell us what's happening with what people have invested in their future security?
Well, it's a awful time to be talking about any cuts to Social Security when people already have huge levels of unemployment, and people that are fortunate enough to have a 401k have seen those be significantly eroded during the recession, and even more so in the last week. It's just not the right time. I was disappointed today to hear the president renew his call for a payroll tax cut, that 2% cut that passed a year ago. And not that I don't think working families can benefit from more money in their pocket, but I think cutting the payroll tax will just increase the pressure to say that Social Security is broke and end up this 2% now will end up costing us a lot more later in terms of reduced benefits and extended retirement ages and things like that. So there wasn't a lot of good news in what I heard the president say today.
There have been, throughout these discussions, demands that the spending of the government be reduced by trillions of dollars. At the end of his statement today, President Obama made a sentimental journey to Afghanistan in regard to the most numerous deaths of special forces operators in that country in a war whose troop commitment he doubled as soon as he got into office. It staggers the imagination that the discussion has not so far prominently included the prospect of ending the multiple wars in Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, the endless occupation there, the new wars in Yemen, Somalia, and Colombia, and elsewhere around the world. Why is the multi-trillion, approaching $10 trillion cumulatively, according to some analysts, why is that not a prominent, if not leading part, of how to reduce government spending?
Well, I think that's a really good question, and some in Congress are starting to take that up. Barney Frank made a very powerful statement this morning, the congressman from Massachusetts, who's the ranking member of the House Financial Services Committee, said that he was going to make talking about defense cuts his mantra for the next coming months, that that's really, he thinks, what was behind the S&P downgrade of the U.S. debt.
Scott, you are with the organization Business for Shared Prosperity. Do you and your colleagues have a different vision, a progressive vision, one that might be more humane and productive or economically successful?
Well, we think so. We're really focused on solutions rather than endlessly ascribing blame and just pointing to the negative sides. And we think there are a couple of very strong solutions to be had, and they have to do with making the tax system fairer and returning some of the balance that existed to those previous years we talked about under President Eisenhower. So two ideas that we advocate are ending the Bush tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans. That would raise $1 trillion over 10 years. And the other is maybe even an easier political sell, is ending the tax haven abuse that many large corporations do, in where they're able to legally shift their profits from the United States to low tax countries like Luxembourg and the Cayman Islands and other places that don't tax corporate income. They do that through accounting tricks, through moving their patents and trademarks and other intellectual property, and then charging a high rate to use those and shift their profits offshore while keeping their expenses here. So they tell the IRS they have lost money, even though they've made a ton of money off of U.S. markets and consumers. And that would also raise $1 trillion a year, closing those tax loopholes for corporations. It's pretty astounding that we went through an exercise last week to cut more than $1 trillion out of social service programs, and we didn't close a single corporate loophole. That's just mind-boggling to me.
We keep hearing about the Bush tax cuts. I thought those were supposed to die a natural death. Why didn't they? And can you give us a concrete example of what wealth may be getting away with under those cuts?
Well, the recent debt ceiling thing was really hostage crisis round two. The first round was back in December when the Democrats wanted to pass an extension to unemployment benefits, and many of the Republicans said that they wouldn't go for that unless the richest 1% of Americans got to continue their tax cuts that passed under President Bush 10 years ago. So that was the first defeat in December, and then round two came last week with the debt ceiling and more cuts for the rest of us, not the wealthiest. Just to give you a little sense of the wealthiest, what life is like for the wealthiest, every year Forbes magazine publishes a list of the 400 richest Americans, and this year, to be on that list, you had to have 8% greater wealth than last year. So while 1 in 8 American families are depending each month on food stamps, the price to get into the richest club has gone up 8%. And if you look at taxes, the IRS releases a list of the tax rates paid by the 400 wealthiest taxpayers. These are people whose income start in the hundreds of millions of dollars. They paid less in 2009 an average of 18% of their income in taxes. That's more than my wife and I paid, and I find that pretty offensive. My wife and I paid more than 18%, and I find that offensive.
Do the bailouts count as a boon similar to the tax cuts?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's rewarding bad behavior even worse. So you have banks taking excessive risks and making speculative investments and paying CEOs and others big bonuses. And then when their bets end up not paying off, they turn to the government and say, bail us out. We did that.
Are you concerned by what may be a constitutional issue of the appointment of a so-called super committee to decide the things that will be cut in the coming months and years?
I'm not a constitutional scholar, so I wouldn't presume to weigh in on that aspect of the question. But in terms of someone who cares about democracy, I think it's something we all should care about. It'll conduct its business out of the public view, as much of this debt ceiling debate was done. And, that's not good for any democracy.
The real pain, if not already in progress, has been strategically timed to occur in 2012 or October or November, just around the time just after the elections. Do you see any political manipulation taking place here? And would you say that any party has been honest in that regard?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of blame to go around, and I wouldn't say there's... particular villain or particular saints. I think that too much is being gamed for political reasons by both parties, and that's hurting the rest of us.
What is the timeline you see happening in terms of reorganization of this or the implementation of it?
Of the super committee's work?
Yes, and the coming cuts and so on.
So the super committee has to finish its report by Thanksgiving and be voted on basically by Christmas or the end of the year. And the cuts will take place starting the middle of next year, is what I understand.
Scott Klinger of the organization Business for Shared Prosperity. I give you the concluding word as to how people can learn more about the progressive proposals of your coalition and how they can be in touch and what we might be thinking of until we next speak.
Well, we'd love to have you learn more about our work. We not only work on corporate tax issues, but also minimum wage and the Consumer Financial Protection Agency and other issues. You can learn more about our work at our website, businessforsharedprosperity.org. And if you're a small business owner, we'd like to have you join up with us.
Well, thank you, Scott Klinger. He is the Director of Tax Policy for Business for Shared Prosperity, a network of forward-thinking business owners, executives, and investors. And we'll stay in touch as this process develops. Thank you for being with us on 5 O'Clock Shadow, Scott Klinger.
Thank you so much.
And one of the more startling revelations over the past several days in regard to what was put on the table or chopping block, as it were, during the budget conflict and negotiations was the issue of Social Security. That is a third rail, a hot issue for many of the people who supported the Democratic Party during the last round of presidential and congressional elections. And we were stunned by a most startling statement from the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, John Conyers, who placed the blame for the negotiated reduction of Medicare and Social Security services not where you might expect it. Here, John Conyers.
Now I'd like to ask Congressman John Conyers, co-chair of the Out of Poverty Conference, to come forward and thank you for being with us today and for your years of fighting for poor people.
Thank you very much, Barbara Lee, and to my colleagues, Lynn Woolsey and Jan Schakowsky and Jerry Nadler. I'm happy that all of us are here today. This is one of the most important issues that we're faced with. And there are a couple of things on my mind. Because everybody's criticizing Republicans. Guess what? Every Republican that's in the Congress was legitimately elected like all of us. That was a choice that voters made. Now, whether they still made it wisely or if they still stick to it remains to be seen. But I say we've got to educate the American people at the same time that we educate the President of the United States. Because the Republicans, the Speaker Boehner or Majority Leader Cantor, did not call for Social Security cuts in the budget deal. The President of the United States called for that. And my response to him is to mass thousands of people in front of the White House to protest this. Look, we can speak to ourselves all we want. Marsha Fudge, my wonderful colleague in the Black Caucus, said, let America be America again. Will somebody please tell me what date they have in mind to let America be America again? The only time there was full employment was during World War II. All the other times there were cyclical ups and downs of employment and unemployment ever since I've been in the Congress. So we don't want America to be America again. We want full employment as a matter of government policy, which was passed in 1987 when I stood with Hubert Humphrey and from the chairman of, then the dean of the Black Caucus, Gus Hawkins, and we passed the first bill that allowed the government in areas of high unemployment to directly intervene and create jobs. Well, we've got the bill in here again, and I've got nothing from the White House. So what I am suggesting doing is what we had to do in the labor movement when the great labor leader was going to march on President Roosevelt because of continuing discrimination. And what did Roosevelt say? Make me do it. Well, what Obama hasn't said to us is make him do it, but we got to make him do it. I mean, if you're going to sit around here and all talk to each other about how much, how bad this is and how bad the other people are that want to continue to support the rich and the wealthy and the powerful, you'd be doing this all your life. Now, there's only one way to do it. Is for the president. I was the first member of Congress to come out for the 44th president. We've got to march on him. He'll be before the Congressional Black Caucus on September 21st, and we want him to know from this day forward, starting with the initiative of the Out of Poverty Caucus, that we've had it. We want him to come out on our side and advocate, not to watch and wait what the D's are doing and the R's are doing in the House and the Senate and all that stuff. We're suffering. And unless we take this economic downturn, and it's a depression in Detroit, 31% unemployed. That's a depression. That's not a recession. Unless we take this opportunity, this tragedy, and turn it into an opportunity by getting the legislation through, we'll be drifting here till next year. And he'll be wondering where all of the people that were so enthusiastic 3 years ago have went. We've got to do something about this. College kids can't, there are no jobs for college kids. There are no jobs for anybody else. And I close on this observation. The automobile industry, which is Detroit, is the center of, they're announcing profits. They're announcing bonuses to their executives. And guess what? The reason they're doing it is they cut the workforce by one-third. That's why they're making money again. But all the people that they fired can't buy cars and can't find other jobs either.
Representative John Conyers, the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, making the remarkable and surprising statement that in the recent budget negotiations, it was President Obama himself who put on the table for reductions the services of Social Security. Conyers is a longtime civil rights activist, member of the Congressional Black Caucus. He was speaking at the Out of Poverty Conference just recently. Perhaps it is that kind of triangulated criticism of the wars and the budget that prompted President Barack Obama to celebrate his August 3rd birthday with yet another fundraiser in Chicago and a change in his explanation of what is change.
So it's been a long, tough journey. But we have made some incredible strides together. Yes, we have. But the thing that we all have to remember is that as much good as we've done, precisely because the challenges were so daunting, precisely because we were inheriting so many challenges that we're not even halfway there yet. And when I said change we can believe in, I didn't say change we can believe in tomorrow. Not change we can believe in next week. We knew this was going to take time. Because we've got this big, messy, tough democracy. And that's a great thing about America is that there are all these contentious ideas that are out there. And we've got to make our case. And we knew that these challenges weren't made overnight and they weren't going to be solved overnight. And so, as we look forward, we know we've still got a lot of work to do on the economy. Now, I hope we can avoid another self-inflicted wound like we just saw over the last couple of weeks. Because we don't have time to play these partisan games. We've got too much work to do. Over the next several months, I hope Congress is focused on what the American people are focused on. Making sure that the economy is growing. Making sure that businesses are getting financing. Making sure that young people are getting trained for the jobs of the future. Making sure that we're getting all those construction workers that got laid off after the housing boom went bust and putting them to work, rebuilding our roads and our bridges, rebuilding Chicago, rebuilding Detroit, rebuilding rural communities all across the country, putting people back to work. I want to make sure that America is not just an importer. I want us to export. I want to build electric cars in America, and I want to ship them all around the world because we've got the best technologies.
President Barack Obama, speaking at a partisan fundraiser in Chicago on the occasion of his 50th birthday, paraphrasing the United Negro College Fund, saying, "I promise you change, but I didn't say when." President Obama is also supporting a $40 billion subsidy for the construction of new nuclear power plants today. Over the weekend, the Nine Mile plant in upstate New York was shut down because of leakage into the containment building of water or perhaps radioactive materials that's still being researched at a rate greater than 10 gallons per minute. Meanwhile, new revelations from Fukushima in Japan indicate that reactor number 3 there possibly melted down twice before the fuel seeped into the concrete floor and into the water table of that doomed facility. That issue, along with discovery of extraordinarily hot spots still being discovered around the plant, prompts this report from our friend Arne Gunderson, the technical analyst of Fairwinds Associates.
Hi, I'm Arne Gunderson from Fairwinds. 2 days ago, Tokyo Electric announced some really high radiation levels on the Fukushima site, and I wanted to put that into perspective, let you know what I think is happening. First off, Tokyo Electric discovered very, very high radiation in a stack, which is used to vent radiation out of the plant and up into the air. The quantity of that radiation was really, really high exposure. It was 10 sieverts. And to convert that over to the to REMs, which I'm used to, is 1,000 REM. Now, what does that mean? 1,000 REM or more, because the instrument went off scale. 1,000 REMs, if you were there for less than half an hour, would mean death within a couple days. Those kinds of exposures cause extensive neurological breakdowns that can't be reversed medically. So basically, to be near that for any amount of time beyond a couple of minutes would be a death sentence. Now, what that means is really interesting. This site has been extensively mapped. There's a map that's current that shows many, many hot spots. This hot spot was not discovered until just a couple days ago. Now, that could mean a couple of things. It could mean really poor health physics and that this was missed for 100 days. I don't think that's the case, but the earlier site maps do not show this high concentration of radioactivity in that area. More likely is that this event happened over time, this radiation built up over time, and that's my theory about how the material was deposited. The key is that it occurred in a vent. Now, that vent was venting the containment for a period of weeks and months before it was the radiation was detected. So, you know, when you start your car up in the morning, you'll see water dripping out the end of the exhaust pipe. Well, I think that's what happened at Fukushima. The hot, humid gases from inside the containment were going up this stack, and where the gases touched the outside of the stack, they were condensing. Well, it wasn't just hot water and hot air, but that also contained lots of cesium. So the cesium and the hot water ran down the outside of the pipe and collected at the bottom. So over a period of time, that concentration got higher and higher and higher. It's likely that the first surveys missed it, and because it just wasn't as high a radioactive source in comparison to all the other radioactive sources that are there. But over time, the concentration went up and up and up as more and more and more water containing cesium came down. Now, it's important to remember that this lethal amount of radiation was found on-site, not off-site, so that's good. But the other piece of that is it was found in a stack. Air was being pulled over that and up and exhausted into the air for a long period of time. I think it really speaks to how much radiation was released over the last 140 days, and that this is just a small portion of what was released to the environment. There's another competing theory, and some people think it was blown into that location during the explosion in the first week. Again, either the health physics practices and measuring that on site were really, really poor, or it wasn't there in the first week and has gradually built up over time. Tokyo Electric has found high radiation in the ground in that vicinity and all around the plant, and in fact has bulldozed some of it under so that workers could access some of these areas. What that means is we're going to continue to see over the next 10 years spikes in radiation on site, first as pieces that were bulldozed actually come to the surface in the excavations. There will continue to be these enormous radioactive sources that are unearthed. And second, when they get into these buildings to actually try to dismantle the plant, they're going to find even higher radiation levels than this one. Remember, at the bottom of the nuclear reactor, the nuclear core has leaked out and is now lying like a pancake on the concrete floor, working its way down, but probably not through the concrete. Now, that is even much more radioactive than this. That's why it's going to take Tokyo Electric 10 or 20 years to clean up. This is not something you send somebody in with shovels to shovel the floor. This is going to have to be done robotically, and it's going to take a long, long time.
Arne Gunderson of Fair Winds Associates. That concludes today's program. We welcome your tips, comments, suggestions, queries, and leaks with an email to theshadow, theshadow at wbai.org, or drop us a letter at WBAI 120 Wall Street, New York, 10005. For 5 o'clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.